Kia ora and welcome to Good Fellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler, and today I welcome to the podcast Professor Julia Rutledge to discuss diet, mental health, and micronutrients. Julia is a professor of psychology and a clinical psychologist at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. She is the director of Te Puna Toi Ora, the Mental Health and Nutrition Research Lab. Julia co-authored the Better Brain book and has over 150 peer-reviewed publications. Originally from Canada, she emigrated to New Zealand in the year 2000. Julia's research focuses on the connection between micronutrients and mental health, conducting clinical trials on micronutrients for conditions like ADHD and mood disorders. Recognised for her contributions, she's received awards such as the Ballon Award and was named Woman of Influence in New Zealand multiple times. Her 2014 TEDx talk has been viewed over 5 million times, and she recently created a fantastic free edX online course for the public on mental health and nutrition, which is well worth completing. Julia is passionate about the role of nutrition in mental health and advocates for a strong nutritional foundation to prevent and address mental health challenges. Kia ora, Julia, it's an honour to be talking to you today.
Oh, I'm delighted to have been invited. Thank you so much, Louise.
So we're providing an update on the relationship between nutrition and mental health, and our focus will be to explore the current state of mental health in the nation and delve into the role of diet. So I wonder if you can start by giving us some statistics.
Sure. I mean, it varies from country to country, and it's sometimes kind of hard to get that full statistic. But the number that most countries seem to be settling in on is about a quarter to a fifth of the population is struggling with a mental health problem in any one given year. Just to give you a sense of the statistics here in New Zealand, from 2010 to 2021, we had an increase in ADHD by 73% based on the New Zealand Health Survey, increase in ASD by 39%, and increase in anxiety by 76%. So that just gives you an idea of how many more people are struggling and, of course, then presenting to primary care or other mental health professionals to try to get some kind of relief from the suffering associated with from these conditions.
So many of our patients claim to eat well, incorporating cereals, sandwiches, salads, sure, vegetables, meat, fish, and some treat snacks. Are the studies comparing different diets in terms of their impact on mental health, and what were the outcomes?
So I think the first thing to tackle is that while people think that they're eating healthy, I'm not necessarily convinced that they are actually eating healthy. And when we look at the big population studies, and I'm not aware of one that's been done in New Zealand per se, but they've been done in Australia, in the UK, North America, Canada, et cetera, so other Western countries, and they're all pretty much showing that about half of the calories that people are consuming at a population level are coming from ultra-processed products. So ultra-processed products are those things that are packaged. They will often have added ingredients to make them tasty, like your emulsifiers, your preservatives, or more shelf life, your flavors, your colors, things that you do not get in your kitchen. But they've also gone through an enormous amount of change in the molecules that are contained within real food. So they are things that our grandparents wouldn't have eaten, our ancestors certainly wouldn't have eaten, but they are pervasive across all Western society. And just to give you a local statistic, 69% of the foods that are sold in supermarkets here in New Zealand are identified as this ultra-processed variety. So they are ubiquitous. That's the first thing to address, that your comment around people think they're eating healthy, but in fact, many people, a high percentage of their diet will consist of these ultra-processed products, even without necessarily knowing it. And the reason for that is that the food industry pretty much has the power over how things are marketed. And so they can market things as being healthy, as being low in fat, low in sugar. So there's all these things that are in packages that are there to lure you into thinking that it's going to be good for you. But for me, it's just ultra-processed food in disguise. So we just need to be really mindful of that. But I think because of things like the health star ratings that sort of lure people to think that it's going to be healthy because it might have a 4.5-star rating like a cereal, pretty much all cereals would be identified as ultra-processed. The problem with eating these foods is that they are low in nutrients. And that is one of the challenges that you and I can talk about. But the question around what do we know about the relationship between eating these types of foods and mental health, there are dozens of studies that are showing that these foods are associated with poor mental health. There's studies that show it's associated with a greater chance of having depression, anxiety, it's associated with ADHD symptoms. There's been a meta review, or it's like an umbrella review that just came out in the BMJ, and it showed the association between the consumption of these ultra-processed products and a whole bunch of health indicators, including mental health, was covered in there as well. So we have enormous amount of evidence that shows that these particular types of foods are associated with poor physical and mental health. I haven't ever seen a study that's shown that it's been good for our mental health. And then on the flip side, the more you're eating foods that are unprocessed or minimally processed, your real whole foods, people know what those are. They're the fruits and vegetables, your nuts, your seeds, your legumes, beans, your chickpeas, your lentils, healthy fats like olive oil, fish, grass-fed meat, those types of foods that are more minimally processed. The more you eat those types of foods in your diet, then it's associated with better mental health. There's such a small conversation on this at a national level, or even within the public healthcare system, that we really do need to be talking about the food environment whenever we are faced with people who are struggling with a mental health issue.
So I was going to ask you about the optimal mental health diet, and I often tell my patients not to go to the supermarket, or if they go to the supermarket, to walk around the outside of the supermarket and don't go into the central aisles.
Yeah.
What advice do you have there?
Sure. I mean, I think that is fantastic advice. Even when it comes to your fresh foods, I would still, if you can afford it, and this is often the backlash I hear about a lot, is that there's no way I can eat this well because it's so expensive. But I have a few things to say on that. One of them is that if you can go to farmers markets, then that will get your freshest fruit and vegetables, that it would likely have been harvested within the last couple of days, as opposed to in the supermarket where it could be a very lengthy period of time. In fact, with some apples, they could have been harvested 9 months ago. So that's the first thing. The other thing I'd say is always eat in season, because then you're getting fruits and vegetables that are grown and are going to do the best within the season that you're in, whether that's summer or winter. The other thing I would suggest is that there are some things that are in supermarkets that are absolutely wonderful and healthy. Your canned tomatoes, frozen vegetables, your peas or the corn, those are going to be harvested at their prime and then frozen, so they retain their nutritional value. I guess those would be some of the first things that I would sort of concur with you around how to eat. But it really is also about, over time, developing a curiosity about food, how to cook food, how to eat nourishing foods. That level of education is something that I think, unfortunately, is missing for some people. And we kind of need to go back to our roots to be able to embrace those types of recipes that we know are going to be really either both fulfilling, provide us with sufficient calories, but also provide us with those nutrients that we know are really, really important for brain health.
So the diet that you've described as optimal being whole foods, nutrient dense, is it sufficient for mental health, or are there additional factors at play, thinking over farming with micronutrient loss in the processing, that we need to think about as well?
Sure. Just to add a few details to the eating whole real food, I always say that's the first place to start, because I think that's something that's like the low hanging fruit, which is around reducing your consumption of ultra processed food, as being that's where we need to encourage the entire population to reduce that consumption of those ultra processed products. I just want to make a comment on other things that might confuse the story, because there's always a lot of talk about going vegan or going vegetarian or carnivore or keto. So there's a lot of diets that are out there that people may think they should follow those types of diets. And I just want to say, first foremost, the first thing to do is to just go towards eating those real whole foods as a starting point. And then if that's not sufficient, then you can consider those other diets. To answer the question about whether or not we need to supplement, and are there reasons why some people may need more nutrients than what they can get out of their food, I think that there is a case for that, in that for a number of different reasons. Some of them might be individual. Some of them are things like you have an inborn error of metabolism that means that there might be just sort of errors that can be made in the making of an enzyme, so it doesn't work quite as well as it should, you can correct that by giving more vitamin and mineral cofactors to support that metabolic reaction. So there might be some individual reasons. There could be things like gut health can influence your ability to absorb nutrients, and so you may need to get more. What you're also talking about is things like our food environment and how we're growing food. I'm starting to delve into this in lots of different ways. In fact, just this week, I was out at Lincoln talking to some agricultural experts and how when they feed their dairy cows a variety of different types of grass or plants, and they call it the salad bar because most of the time they're just eating one type of grass. But in fact, they're offering them a full variety. And what they find is that they have better milk production and they also have better metabolites that are available in the milk. So it's just a healthier product that they're getting at that. So it tells us that some of our farming practices have kind of gone astray because we've ended up with a lot of monoculture. And what that means is that you end up with depletions of nutrients in the soil that in turn end up in the plants that are grown. And then that in turn will affect human health. And in that case, I'm just giving an example of animal health, but that will in turn have an impact on human health. So if you don't remineralize the soil adequately, and what we do a lot of the time is just give sort of your NPK fertilizer, your nitrogen, your phosphorus, your potassium, and not put in other trace elements and minerals that are really essential for proper health of those plants. So things like your boron or your selenium or your iodine, things that we know are depleted in New Zealand soils are not getting adequately put back in. Given that humans cannot make these minerals, they can make a few B vitamins, but for the most part, they have to get their vitamins and minerals from plants or from an animal that ate those plants. So if the plants don't have the adequate nutrients in the soil, then that's going to influence overall human health. So that's something that we do need to consider. Supplementation of vitamins and minerals is basically, in a way, compensating for something that's down the road. I mean, I would absolutely prefer that we sorted out our soils, that the incentives for farmers were such that they could look after their soils properly, not use glyphosate, which is can influence the mineral content and the microbiome of your soil. So maybe going back to some of our ancestral roots around how we looked after the land, that would be the first thing that I would do. I would want to see done. But in the interim, an alternative solution is to supplement with additional vitamins and minerals that people can't get out of their food, either because of what we're talking about here, which is the food production, or that they're simply making choices of foods that are nutrient poor.
Fantastic. Thank you for that, Julia. So you've mentioned nutrients and vitamins and minerals. So I wonder if you could elaborate on the specific things that you're talking about that are necessary for optimal mental health.
Sure. I think what we've grown up thinking about when it comes to our food is that it's about its macronutrients. So we think about its fat, its protein content, its carbohydrate content. And those are essential, of course, and they're important for us to make sure that we eat those. But it's overshadowed the focus on the micronutrients. And those are nutrients that we need to consume in much smaller amounts, but they are so important and so essential for all the metabolism that's happening in not just your brain, but all over your body. So these vitamins and minerals are things that will support the making of neurotransmitters. So for example, serotonin or dopamine. So if you just think of the conversion of tryptophan, which you consume in your diet, and you would convert that to serotonin, you need enzymes to support that transaction, but you also need vitamins and minerals. And there's thousands and thousands of these metabolic reactions that are happening all the time, and they're all dependent on a different kind of combination of vitamins and minerals. And what's really important is that we don't get too focused on one specific nutrient, like zinc or vitamin D or B6, which can often happen in science because we're so used to wanting to manipulate one variable at a time. Or if we think about the pharmaceutical model, that's always one molecule at a time. So if we could just sort of move away from that way of thinking, then we realize that actually, in order for these metabolic reactions to occur, you need this full support, the full array of these vitamins and minerals. And there's about 30 of them, plus or minus. They are things that people will have heard of. Like, I've mentioned some of them, but, you know, magnesium, copper, manganese, your vitamin Bs, your vitamin E, D, that's what I'm talking about. They're also really essential for supporting mitochondria, which we are either a few of those in every cell, or you could have hundreds of those in a cell. Again, the mitochondria are often talked about as powerhouses of the cell, which is kind of a simple way of thinking about it, but they are important for making the energy molecule ATP. What a lot of people aren't sort of that familiar with is how many vitamins and minerals support that production or that Krebs cycle to make the ATP. So that's another thing that those vitamins and minerals are doing. So if you don't have that adequate supply of those vitamins and minerals from your diet, then you're going to start to feel really slow and sluggish, and you might feel your brain will be foggy. You're just not feeling like you're operating on full cylinders. So one way of being able to support that is to make sure that you eat an adequate supply of these vitamins and minerals, either from your food or through supplementation. I just wanted to really emphasize for your listeners is how important they are. I mean, I could go on about their importance in helping keep your genes healthy, supporting methylation. There's a whole host of different things that those vitamins or minerals are responsible for. But at the end of the day, you can't make them, so you've got to eat them.
So tell us about some research with the use of micronutrients, and in what conditions have benefits been observed?
The idea of studying one vitamin or mineral at a time has been around for over 100 years. So there's been an enormous amount of research that's been done looking at the effects of one nutrient, one micronutrient on, say, depression or schizophrenia or anxiety, et cetera. And overall, when you look at that research, it's pretty modest. Yes, you see some maybe positive effects of one nutrient, but for the most part, that approach hasn't really been that successful. So the approach that I've been taking, but also other researchers around the world, I'm not the only one, is taking this concept of a broad spectrum micronutrient approach, which is to give that full array of nutrients in balance and to see whether or not they can have a positive effect on different mental health challenges. So where I started was with ADHD, and we now have a sufficient amount of evidence for ADHD using this broad spectrum approach to say that it's an evidence-based treatment. You just need two randomized controlled trials in order to be able to establish something as evidence-based. And we've got three. That there were two done in New Zealand, one with adults, one with children, one was done in the US on a multi-center site. So we have good evidence for that. I also always think people need to know that it doesn't treat everybody. It's not 100%, but we get good responses of about 50% showing a really substantial change, 30% showing some benefit, but not fully. And then there's about 20% who show no changes whatsoever. Another area that's got good evidence is in the area of autism. And those studies have been done in the States primarily, but also showing benefit for symptoms associated with autism, like the temper tantrums, the challenges with receptive gaze. So there's been some benefits that have been observed in some of those areas that can be challenging when parenting or when somebody has those symptoms associated with ASD. There's a lot of evidence supporting the use of broad spectrum nutrients for reducing anger, aggression in prisoners. Sufficient evidence there that it really should be something that all our prisons in New Zealand should be doing. When it comes to the anger and aggression, we've had so many studies that have shown that that's almost like the first thing that benefits. I would just love it if we would consider this more when it comes to our children before putting them on medications that we know can come with an undesirable side effects, at least with some of them, because the benefit there is so obvious, or it can be so obvious and really quite quick as well to see the benefits when it comes to the emotional dysregulation. The other ones that I didn't mention earlier was depression and stress. We've done some really not placebo-controlled trials on stress, although people in other centers have, but there is a really interesting body of research that we've done post either natural disasters or other types of disasters that really show the importance of B vitamins in particular as something to take to support you under extreme levels of stress. And that's based on research we did after the Christchurch earthquakes, the mosque shooting here, and then floods in other places around the world. So there is a pretty solid body of evidence to support the use of the vitamins and minerals for stress. Depression, I just wanted to make a comment on that one, that we did an RCT that did show benefit of the broad spectrum micronutrients for depression, more so in terms of just leading to a faster relief of symptoms. But I also want to say that just like antidepressants, we are very prone to the placebo effect when it comes to depression. So our placebo effect was really high, just like you see in antidepressant studies as well. So we do need to see more replication in that area with bigger sample sizes.
Using or prescribing micronutrients, yeah. My understanding is in New Zealand, this is regulated. So how does one go about prescribing them and what protocol should be followed?
Yeah, the regulation in New Zealand is complicated, but it's complicated around the world. But if just to talk about New Zealand specifically, the regulation of supplements is that it's actually a food. And that is what makes it complicated, because as soon as you show medicinal effects, it falls into this gray zone if it's a medicine, but that would mean you'd have to have that entire array of nutrients in that particular combination go through MedSafe approval as a medicine. So that means you end up it being an unapproved medicine, and that's what makes it a challenge in order to be able to get access to it. Because it's no longer a supplement because it's been proven to have benefit or efficacy. So that affects its regulation, but it can't be sold as a food because the nutrient levels are higher than what is allowed in a supplement. So I'm sorry, Louise, that I'm complicating it, but it is a complicated story. I hope that was sufficient in terms of sort of explaining the challenges. But it's not that you can't get access to it in New Zealand. You can, but the way around this very old legislation is essentially to have it available to practitioners, to prescribers, to say, yes, I'm happy for my client to take these micronutrients, and then sort of approve the sale of the micronutrients to the consumer. So that's the workaround. And it's not that I haven't tried to find a better workaround. I've talked to lots of MPs about the problem. I keep asking to see Matt Ducey, who's the new Minister of Mental Health, and could you please solve this problem, because it is confusing for consumers and it's confusing for prescribers. But at the same time, I also want to make sure and reassure your audience that you can get hold of them, but you just have to simply, as a prescriber, approve the sale of the micronutrients. That also means that the prescriber can make sure that if the person is taking medications, particularly psychiatric medications, that it's done carefully and slowly, because the observations that have been made over time internationally from psychiatrists who've used the micronutrients alongside medications is that you need to reduce the dose of the medication over time as the micronutrients are titrated in. And so that cross tapering needs to just be done carefully. It's not, again, it's something that can be done, but the prescriber needs to be aware of that, because if they're not aware of it, then the person is basically ends up being a bit over-medicated. And so then you end up with an increase in the side effects associated with the medication, which is, of course, undesirable. So that's, again, a reason why it's sold in this way, is so that when it's sold to somebody who's on medications, that's done professionally and appropriately.
Can you talk more specifically to that? Because I remember when my first patient came to me asking for micronutrients, I had no idea, and actually wrote to you and said, what do I do?
Oh, okay.
So what are we talking about as far as products, and what exactly are we writing and to whom?
Ah, okay. I try to stay well away from all of this, the side of the selling of it and also the prescribing of it, because I'm not a prescriber. So I just kind of try to educate people on the science and what has been documented, and then saying this is how you do it. So in New Zealand, it's only the micronutrients are sold now, actually, from a variety of different practitioners. I've seen it pop up in different places all around New Zealand. They simply require a letter from a GP. They provide the template. So my understanding is it's super simple, but just so that people are forewarned, that is something that they will need to do, is to provide that letter to the company who is selling the micronutrient product, and then they'll sell it on to the consumer. So it's just kind of like a way of ensuring there's safety, a safety net around the sale of it. Because the last thing we want people to do is to stop their medications and to go on the micronutrients, you know, just go buy them in a health food store. So it's really trying to ensure that it's used really safely and that there aren't inadvertent negative effects that happen as a consequence of the micronutrient use.
Yeah. Are there any other precautions or considerations that we need to think about when prescribing micronutrients?
I mean, sometimes they come up and it's things like if you start to understand that it's not about specifically, it's not a target for a disorder. Like it's not like you think of Ritalin as being the treatment for ADHD or, you know, an antidepressant as treatment for depression. It's more of a metabolic tune-up where you're providing the essential nutrients that the body needs to function optimally. So when you think about it from that perspective, then you start to understand why some things happen. So for example, we're working with teens right now in a study. And if a teen goes through a growth spurt, then parents will come and say to me, oh, the nutrients aren't working anymore. And I'll go, oh, did they grow a little bit over the last, is there been something that's happened that might help us understand that? So when you realize that the growth cycle requires nutrients, then you can understand that when you have a finite supply, then they're going to get diverted to this other metabolic challenges that the person, the individual is going through. Sickness is another one, is that when people get ill and they're fighting an infection, then the nutrients are going to be diverted to that. If you're stressed, if you suddenly have an increase in your stress, your fight-flight response is very nutrient hungry. So when you can think about it from that perspective, then you start to understand why over time there might be some changes in its effectiveness. Surgery might be another one. You know, there's just things that can happen that will influence whether or not the micronutrients end up being diverted to emotion regulation or whether or not they end up doing something different. So just bearing that in mind, it helps sort of understand the sequence of events that might happen. This is not a substitute for a good diet. So encouraging people to start to be changing some of their diet choices. Although one thing we've observed over time is that their diet choices do change and they don't crave certain things as much as they might have once done. And that makes sense from the perspective of if you're providing the nutrients that are required for emotion regulation, then you may not seek out foods that do the same thing. The benefit of the nutrient approach is that it's more long-term and it's sustained, whereas when you seek out that donut, it will provide you with some, you know, temporary relief from emotion dysregulation, but it'll be right back with you in a couple of hours. So it's a very, very different approach to supporting the body and what it needs. I'm just trying to think if there's other ones. Your gut health, that is something that I think often co-occurs. Are people with IBS? We're having a really increase in people complaining about those symptoms. I haven't done any research on probiotics for supporting gut health, but anecdotally, we've had people try probiotics. But what I can say is that when we've told people to give that a go, their gastrointestinal problems seem to sort of settle. Maybe one day I'll do research on it, but not today.
So, Julie, just can we touch on micronutrients? If you could just inform us why the dosing of micronutrients is so much higher than the RDIs.
Yeah, so just I'm assuming your audience knows that there's these RDAs or RDIs, the recommended dietary allowance, that tells us how much we should consume on a daily basis. But what I think people don't realize is that it's a minimum. It's sort of what you require to avoid the general or the average or most of the population from getting something like scurvy or rickets. But it's not a number that you should be following in order to determine what's best for optimal health. And the other thing is that it's for an average healthy population. And of course, the people we're talking about do not fall into that category that the RDA was developed for, because the people who we're talking about have got either often, you know, mental illness, but they probably also have physical illnesses as well. So the RDA is not a great concept to apply to people who are actually struggling. The other thing is that they were developed with the heart in mind and bones in mind. It was first developed after World War II in order to make sure that the armed forces were adequately nourished to fight. So they weren't thinking about the brain. They were thinking about physical organs. And so again, the brain has been neglected in this whole discussion. And the sad thing about that is that while the brain is only 2% of body weight, it punches above its weight in terms of the nutrients that it consumes. So it consumes between 20 to 40% of what you eat. And so when you think about it from that perspective, really when you eat, you're feeding your brain. To put those things together collectively, you realize that the RDA isn't an adequate number for brain health. I almost sometimes think that the food industry has supported the RDA concept because their foods are so low in these nutrients. And so, you know, if you were to raise that, you would shed more light on the fact that these foods that we're eating are so nutrient poor. If you think about an orange, or a kiwi fruit that we export to other countries, the vitamin C in a kiwi fruit is higher than RDA. And we certainly don't jump up and down and kind of worry about harming the export business. So I think we need to sort of be a bit more open-minded around the rigidity associated with the RDA. All of that to say is that you can eat foods, and everybody who's eating a real whole food diet will be consuming nutrients above RDA every day, is to know that a more important indicator is the UL, which is the upper limit. And that's the number where it can sometimes be 10 times, 100 times higher than the RDA. In some cases, there is no upper limit for some nutrients that we consume, like B12, because it's a water-soluble nutrient, and so you just get rid of any excess. So the UL is a number that's been derived to sort of say, if you go above that, then you might increase the chances of having a negative effect or some kind of toxic effect from a nutrient. And so that it might be useful for, say, ensuring that you don't end up with a copper deficiency if you take too much zinc, for example. If you're taking zinc and copper together, though, the UL associated with zinc no longer applies. It doesn't make any sense anymore. So the ULs were developed with the individual nutrient in mind, and yet we tend to eat nutrients in combination, unless you're just taking one nutrient. As I was saying earlier, is probably not the right approach anyway. So I hope I've kind of given that little background about why in our research we have been operating above the RDA in terms of the doses for the nutrients, but typically below the UL unless there's a logical reason to go above it. And as I sort of explained, some of those logical reasons like zinc and copper.
Fantastic. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you today. And I'm wondering if there are primary care practitioners, if they're wanting to delve deeper into this topic, where can they go to seek some reliable information?
Goodness. Publications, we've done a lot of reviews, so that's a useful place to go. We've written book chapters about this. So any Google search for my name, you'd end up with a lot of those kind of review places to go for practitioners that have been written over the last couple of years. I don't know, where else? Where would I tell people to go to? I've got a TEDx that's out there. It's a bit dated. I mean, it's almost 10 years old, though. But I still think that other than we've got more research available and I could now make a stronger case, I still think it's relevant. I think it's a good place to go for an 18-minute overview of this field.
Fantastic. Thank you, Julia. And to conclude our podcast, your take-home messages for our listeners, please.
Sure. Okay. So while patients might think they eat a healthy diet, it may well incorporate a lot of ultra-processed foods. Half of the calories consumed in the Western world are coming from these ultra-processed products. Research has robustly shown, based on epidemiological studies, control trials, that our choice of diet is influencing our mental health. Supplementation with additional micronutrients may be necessary for some people, even if they eat a good diet. And there are now randomized control trials that have demonstrated efficacy of broad-spectrum micronutrient supplementation for the treatment of ADHD, aggression, symptoms associated with autism.
Wonderful. Thank you once again for your time today, Julia. If you're a New Zealand GP and would like to claim CPG points, these podcasts are eligible, so please log them, and I'll put a list of our resources used in making this podcast on our website, goodfellowunit.org. Thanks for joining us today.